now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades. This is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
Friday Night Lights, high school football, is an American tradition. In some parts of the country, it's a religion. And there have been so many stories that we have done over the last number of years and have been appeared nationally on the concussive head injury issue as related to football, not just football, by the way, soccer as well as other contact sports. And it was just a matter of time before somebody advanced legislation. And in California, it's Assembly members Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher and Assembly member Kevin McCarty who have proposed the Safe Youth Football Act that would ban essentially organized tackle football under the age of high school, the high school years. In other words, it would, tackle football could still be played from freshman year of high school onward, but Pop Warner, Pee Wee football, all that stuff would go on the organized level, would go bye-bye. Joining us to talk about this right now is the California Assemblyman, Kevin McCarty. Good morning, Assemblyman. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning to you.
Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. So I certainly understand the motive for this. We've done enough stories, as anybody who's even superficially looked at this, the scientific evidence is really pouring in. It's almost overwhelming that the cumulative effect of concussive head injuries can have a devastating impact on people's lives. And it starts at a very early age. The question is, how does this, if this passes, how does this impact high school football? I mean, we put a feeler out to talk to a couple of high school coaches in the next few days to kind of see how it would alter their programs. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I've spoken to a few coaches as well, high school coaches, and there's mixed results. But, you know, look at the Super Bowl 2 weeks ago. One of the star quarterbacks, Tom Brady, he didn't play football till high school. Drew Brees, a Californian who's starting his own flag football league here, didn't start till high school. So there are plenty of superstars that started tackle football at the high school level. But I think the bigger picture is what you said earlier. There's vast research coming in that shows that young brains and big hits is just not a good combination. And so what I'm proposing is the Safe Youth Football Act, which would set a minimum age for tackle football, but also focus on an alternative too. You know, we have flag football leagues, which are great for skill development, and frankly, maybe you can get more kids participating in flag football and still be able to have your Friday Night Lights for high school programs when young kids are more developed, you know, post-puberty.
I know it's early in the process, but where do you see the opposition coming from?
Oh, I've really rattled up a hornet's nest here, and there's a lot of opposition. Just, you know, go to my social media sites are for Assembly member Lorena Gonzalez, and there's a lot of passion for parents. Look, let's face it. Parents don't want to think that they're doing anything bad to their kids. A lot of these parents are probably conflicted themselves. You know, these football leagues have been promoting these heads up and safer tackling and safer helmets, but research shows no matter what helmet you put on there, that hits to the brain, whether it's a concussion or a subconcussion, you know, rattles the brain. And, you know, brains is like a soft balloon inside a hard a shell. And it just doesn't lend itself well to taking these hits. And, you know, research shows some of these little kids as early as 5 years old can take up to 500 hits per year. And it just has a cumulative impact and just doesn't make sense.
Well, that is the unique problem of football because the contact – well, you can suffer a head injury in any sport or doing almost anything, but with football, virtually every play from scrimmage, somebody is taking a concussive head hit because
that's the game.
What the offensive and defensive line is certainly doing. So maybe the quarterback doesn't get sacked or the wide receiver can run their route without getting
But they try to
knocked.
Every play.
So yeah. It's just an ingrained portion of the game. A couple years ago, we interviewed the men's soccer coach for the UCLA men's soccer team. And he was very upfront about saying that it's a great concern in his sport as well because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that heading a soccer ball puts a lot of impact on the skull. It also creates a lot of pressure on the spine, you know, and the discs in the neck. But obviously, it's the head injuries that are a great concern. So these are things that we just didn't address. I will say that historically speaking, you know, the NCAA was created during the Theodore Roosevelt administration. And Theodore Roosevelt being Theodore Roosevelt, he believed in manly sports, and he believed in physical, vigorous physical exercise. But football was almost killed off 100 years ago. Because back then, in the in the Leatherhead days, it was incredibly violent. I mean, incredibly violent. There was virtually no protective equipment whatsoever. And one of the reasons the NCAA was created was to try to civilize the game a little bit. But, you know, you look at the size of people today, as you have, Assemblyman, that's the thing. Kids are big. I mean,
fast,
everybody's big and strong, and the training and the diet and, who knows, performing-enhancing drugs and all the other issues that are in here. Some of these kids in high school are monsters.
Yeah, and you know, people could debate whether or not you should even have high school football, but I think more and more research shows for our littlest kids, you know, for the kids, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, up to 14 years old, they're still developing. It doesn't really make sense. And, you know, there's criticism, frankly, twofold. It says, one, there's California again being nanny government. And two, why football? Why not soccer and lacrosse or snowboarding? You know, two California kids just won the gold.
Uh-huh,
they're teenagers, right? And I guess the answer to those two things is one, there are times when government steps up and protects young people. It doesn't just let parents call the shots. For example, we have laws on car seats. We have laws on kids and cigarettes. We have laws on kids and vaccinations, which is controversial as well. But, you know, sometimes when research rises up, you know, government can step up as well and protect young people.
Well, I got to be honest with you. In the past, Assemblyman, on this show, we have suggested that the capital of California move from Sacramento to Banning. Because, you know, we thought it would save everybody a lot of trouble. But in this case, I mentioned before, if there was a manufacturing sector in the American economy where the assembly line had the level of injuries that the NFL produces, for instance, in any given year, OSHA would shut them down. I mean, there's no way in the world you could have a manufacturing outfit and have as many injuries, grave, serious injuries, to your workers that the employees of the NFL suffer on any given year.
And on this issue, too, it is controversial, but research and polling shows the majority of Americans support this, support having a minimum age of 14 in high school for tackle football by an overwhelming majority. So it is controversial. You have to start somewhere. And that, as you mentioned earlier, in other sports, snowboarding, skateboarding, you know, there's a chance you could hit your head. There's a chance if the jump doesn't go right. But in football, every play.
Right. It's
every
built
play,
into the game.
A hit.
It's the game.
That's the name of the game. And so that's why I think you have to start somewhere and just, you know, again.
Where does the bill stand now? What happens to
the bill
to
was
it
just announced. We haven't even introduced the language yet, so that'll be coming this week. And so we will have hearings on this in the spring, and it will be a hot topic. There are a lot of opinions both ways on this.
All right. Hey, listen, thank you for coming on and talking to us about it. By the way, you can follow Assemblyman Kevin McCarty on Twitter at ASM for Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, MCCARTY. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, for a couple of days, we've been talking to you about a proposed piece of legislation by Assembly members Kevin McCarty, who we had on yesterday, and Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher of San Diego. It's called the Safe Youth Football Act, and it would ban organized tackle football before high school. In other words, you know, Pop Warner or Pee Wee League football tackle would be verboten.
Got to have flag or two-touch.
And I was curious as to how that might impact high school football programs. Friday Night Lights, an American tradition, of course. We have this right now on the Newsmaker line, the coach of the Division I California State Champions, and it's a pleasure to welcome the head coach of the Narbonne High School Gauchos in Harbor City, Manuel Douglas. Mr. Douglas, coach, how are you? Mr. Coach.
Hey, good morning. How are you? Thank you.
Thank you
for
so
having
much.
Me, actually.
I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. So I actually went to one of the few high schools in America that didn't have a football team. We had an ice hockey team, basketball and baseball. But we didn't have a football team. So I really don't know. But, I we're watching the Olympics and you see – Chloe Kim win a gold medal at 17, and she's been on a snowboard since she was 3. So, is it possible to be great at football and not play it from an early age?
I guess you can. We've had some kids come play who've never really had played youth football. A lot of linemen, because there's 8 weight requirements. They're able to play and they're adequate, but. Some of the better players have been playing their entire life, and obviously there's a difference, a skill set that becomes much more prepared to play in high school. That youth football does provide an opportunity for these kids to, develop that. But, I can see both sides of the argument. I absolutely can.
Yeah, obviously, look, the sport of football, and not just football, we talked to the head coach of the men's the varsity UCLA soccer team a couple years ago about this, and hitting a soccer ball can create a lot of concussive head injuries as well. And you can hurt yourself playing virtually any game, and you can have an accident in life. The difference is, obviously, on every play from scrimmage, there's contact in football. And the legislator, Kevin McCarty, was talking about how kids can have 500 hits a year in an average season, and the cumulative effect obviously is of grave concern. I guess my question for you is, how does this, if this were to become law, how would this impact how you coach and how, your incoming freshmen, would you have to start it really sort of like a remedial football program?
Well, in all honesty, the way it is right now is the fact that, the kids taking those hits and practicing, it could happen at any time, right? You may never have a concussion, but there's obviously the cumulative effect. So it affects how we practice now. We limit the type of contact we have, how much full contact we have within a week. We're not really, if you're smart about it, you're not really going super hard every day and trying to, and more walk and talk. So we do amend our practices even now. But if kids are coming into high school and not having ever played youth football, I think that it also exposes them to the opportunity to be injured in another way, because their bodies aren't physically prepared for the physicality of the game. So, if you're smart, you're definitely going to slow things down. It's going to slow the game down. It'll be a cumulative effect on the entire, game of football, and it's going to start in high school and it'll spread to college. The skill sets just won't be completely or as developed as they are now. So I do agree, though. As a head coach, I have a young son. My son's not going to play youth football, and he won't play probably till, if he does play, if he chooses to play, actually, till at least the 7th grade. I feel like the little kids that are playing so young, and I've seen some of those hits, it's just unnecessary. Aside from the fact that these kids get hit in the head, I think that the physicality of it as they're developing as, little people, I just feel like we don't need to impose those hits on some of these kids at that young of an age. So.
Well, that's fascinating. We're talking about Manuel Douglas, who's the head coach of the Narbonne High School Gauchos in Harbor City, and they were the Division I California state champs. By the way, congratulations. That's quite an accomplishment.
Oh, thank you very much. We're very fortunate.
Yeah. How's the team look this year?
We're going to be a solid, strong team. We've been very consistent over the last 10 years. So it's our second in 3 years, and we've been blessed. We've got a lot of talent, good coaches, so. Hopefully we can do it again.
The game, football, is an American passion, and at the pro level, obviously it's been a really tough year for the NFL. The Super Bowl was great, and that certainly helps them. But between political protests, between concussive head injury issues, between, rap sheets for players, the president, getting into arguments with the NFL, et cetera, and all that stuff. But the game is definitely in the crosshairs, and there are people who would like to see the sport banned completely. I assume that would be something you would be unalterably opposed to.
Well, I mean, I personally love the game of football. It's a beloved game, and it's a part of our American culture. I hope it never comes to that point, but there obviously are things that we need to do as coaches and leaders in the sport that where we protect our kids and protect the adults, you know, anyone who plays this game. But, I mean, obviously there are risks. Aside from head injuries, there's, you know, spinal injuries, there's any kind of injury that happen, and they're very serious. And, you know, people need to go into that with that mindset, understanding. I mean, you conceivably could walk down the street, step off the curb, and break your neck. I mean, it happens. It has happened. It's not something that happens all the time. So I think that, you know, getting, you know, the education part of it and getting it out there, understanding there are certain ways that you can practice. There are things that you can do that can limit these types of injuries, and concussion being the biggest one that everyone's talking about now. And it's something that's been there for the longest time. I remember when I played high school, getting knocked out in practice, cold, not even remembering what happened. But by, you know, 20 minutes later, getting up and conditioning with the rest of the team, we ran 20 gassers. And that was just the norm. That was, you know, understood, you know. And if I didn't get up and run with the team, I was considered weak or not as good a player or trying to get out of practice. I'll never forget that. And I think the mentality now, the mindset has changed that, that's just, we don't allow that. We're always aware of kids. I think though we still need a much more progress in that area, but that's what's going to save our game, you know. And if not, you know, the voices of mothers are strong. So at some point, you know, parents are just going to say, you know, we're not going to allow our kids to play, and, you know, we'll lose this game, and it'll be death by non-participation.
Hey, Coach, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it. Manuel Douglas, head coach of the California State Champs, the Gauchos in Harbor City. Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, the folks who are on the receiving end of the Recycla program, not so happy with trash, and neither is City Councilman Mitch Englander, who was the lone no vote when this City Council-created nightmare was orchestrated at the very end of 2016. And Mitch Englander, along with Paul Kerkorian, introduced a motion asking the city attorney, Mike Fuhrer, to report back with steps that would have to be taken to get out of the Recycla program, period. Joining us right now on the Newsmaker line to talk about this is City Councilman Mitch Englander. Good morning, Councilman Englander.
Good morning, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. And thanks for coming on to talk about this. We spoke to you when this was first proposed, and you were a no vote,
right,
and are now leading the call to undo this. $35 billion, Mitch, is a lot of money, $3.5 billion a year. It's hard, just from my experience living here for so many years and observing L.A. as it is, it's hard to imagine the city council voting to let go of that kind of dough, even though this program seems to be doomed to fail the users, the citizens.
Well, this wasn't predictable. It was predicted, which
right,
is why I was against it. I authored 14 motions during the process of all the hearings to try to stop this thing. The director himself of the Bureau of Sanitation said this was going to be cost neutral. Prices wouldn't necessarily go up. They've gone up 300 to 400% in some cases. It's just astronomical. Missed trash pickups. So what I'm looking for now, and have joined along, I'm thrilled that my colleague council member Paul Kerkorian signed on to my motion. We're asking for the city attorney to report back on how do we get out of these contracts if these providers are not, these haulers are not in compliance with the agreements. And you know, a lot of the goals and the objectives of this, whether it was having a clean fleet or less trucks, all those things could have been done and still could be done.
Well, you know, we got the point that everything that the objectives of Recycla could have been accomplished under the old system. We just needed to regulate the trash trucks. If the idea was simply to clean the air in L.A. because we had all these garbage trucks driving around picking up trash, well, we could have licensed them and fixed that problem without creating monopolies. I mean, where in the world do monopolies provide better service at a better price? This is the
right.
You know, I mean, it's so frustrating because this is common sense 101.
Well, I think you have to go back. It wasn't just about cleaning up the trucks, because that would have been easy to mandate that if you're going to have a permitted trash truck in the city of Los Angeles, there has to be clean fuel or CNG. That part would have been easy. I think the ultimate goal of this was organizing it and making sure everything was unionized was the principal objective beyond recycling and mandated recycling, which was also already starting to be done in multifamily and rolling that out to commercial. Those are things that, again, could have been done without monopolies, if you will, or exclusive franchises. And so, again, now where we're at is we need to look at ways to undo any one of these contracts. And this is a message to all the haulers who have these agreements. If you are not in compliance with the contract, we're going to come after you with everything we have, because our customers, our residents, our businesses are being dramatically affected and impacted, and it's just wrong.
We're talking with City Councilman Mitch Englander. You can follow on Twitter at @Mitch_Englander. I really do look at this as a self-inflicted wound. And with due respect to your colleague, Paul Kerkorian, who used last Tuesday's City Council meeting to lay into some of these deep-pocketed bid winners about putting the mom and pops and the small carting companies out of business. They didn't put them out of business. The L.A. City Council and Mayor Garcetti put them out of business.
Well, and this was years and years of a lot of input, which what I was amazed at, you know, and again, I was deeply involved in writing, I think I mentioned earlier, 14 different motions to try to stop this thing. There was not a huge public outcry during 5 years of public debate and discussion. There wasn't a tremendous amount of media coverage, and yet this was one of the biggest dramatic changes that was occurring in terms of this industry and waste collection in the country. And these kind of numbers were staggering. And, you know, so here we are, easy to point a lot of different fingers. Our responsibility now is to complain, which we need everybody to continue to do. We need to hear people's feedback with the problems they're experiencing, because it gives us those tools of ammunition of communication to articulate what's wrong with the contracts and break them apart if they're not working. And so that's what we need to hear on what's happening out there with all the different providers.
All right. Thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue, obviously, to cover the story. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the Morning weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM. We start with a story that we have discussed many times, which is the exodus from California. And this is a real phenomenon. You don't notice it, obviously, if you're on the 405 or the 710, the 605, any of the freeways, the 91. You know, you're trying to get to Torrance, and you had to leave on Tuesday to get there because the population keeps going up. But we're actually, that's the birth rate and arrivals of immigrants, both legal and illegal immigration. Native-born population, we're hemorrhaging people. The fourth quarter of 2017 saw people in expensive, high-tax coastal markets like San Francisco and Los Angeles split. And one of the things that they're actually talking about now is taxes, because the taxes are pricing people out of their homes. Senior economist at Redfin joins us right now. It's a pleasure to welcome Taylor Marr. Taylor, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on with us. First of all, tell folks about Redfin. What does Redfin do?
Sure. Redfin is a national real estate brokerage. So we have real estate agents all across the country, and we also heavily empower technology to help people buy and sell homes. So we have a website where you can go and search for homes all across the country, and we have a number of different tools powered by data science, such as estimating the value of a home and predicting how fast a home will sell, things like that.
And what's fascinating, the data, in San Francisco, there was a net outflow of 15,489 people. And in Los Angeles, yeah, it was 11,326. Now, again, people are not – this doesn't mean that we're going to start to see – stretches of San Francisco and Los Angeles resembling Detroit, you know, or other Rust Belt cities. We're going to see block after block of abandoned buildings. But it does indicate that there's something going on that's not a sign of that's a trouble sign, because people don't usually leave places like this if it's working for them.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, what's interesting is that California as a whole has been losing residents year after year for decades. And, you know, it, as you mentioned, it's partly offset by positive immigration, both legal and illegal. You know, in San Jose, which has the second highest immigration rate in the country as a metro, gets a lot of, you know, people moving there for high-paying wealth jobs, and that in turn pushes California residents out to more affordable areas. In L.A., it seems to be a little bit different. Obviously there's a lot of population growth, but it's interesting to look at where people are moving all over. And so we have data on that as a website. We can track where people are looking to move, where they're at. And that's something that I've developed to essentially understand how people think about moving across the country.
It's very interesting. For instance, when you look at the 2016 tax rates and tax burdens in the District mm-hmm. of Columbia, a nationwide comparison report, let's talk about some of the data here. For 18.2% of all Redfin.com searches for homes in Las Vegas in the fourth quarter came from L.A. A family earning mm-hmm. $150,000 who made this move could save $7,785 in taxes and would likely pay less for a similar home. Actually, I have a number of friends who've moved to Las Vegas. And
I considered moving to Vegas with my husband when we were having our second kid as well.
You get so much more for your dollar there in terms of home. Now, to me, the downside is you got to live in Las Vegas.
Exactly.
Which is what I don't want to do. But the bottom line is that if you've got a young family and you have the ability to relocate, your dollar goes a lot farther. And for certainly a lot of retirees, I know we did this story a number of years ago, but California lost $20 billion with a B in wealth to Nevada alone of people who retired to Vegas and just took their wealth with them.
That's incredible. Yeah, taxes are a big component, I think, that are on top of mind for everyone. Now, you know, the tax reform bill wasn't passed at the time of this data, and this is looking at the last few months of 2017. But it is interesting when you crunch the numbers to see how different just a couple of percentage points in either income tax or even property taxes make with someone they're looking to buy a home and settle. You're right that it has a tremendous impact on those high earning and high wealth individuals. And that's, other census data have shown that those are primarily who are influenced by the tax rates. The ones who have the most to lose.
We're talking with Taylor Marr, who's a senior economist at Redfin, redfin.com. Is there, it's not surprising that the top three for exodus, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., if you want to go four, and five is Chicago. These are the biggest cities. These are the most expensive places to live as a general rule. Seattle's also high in the list in Houston. And it's, how do you keep them down on the farm once they've seen Paris? The bottom line is for a number of reasons, for both career opportunities and for social life and cultural attractions, for sex, for crying out loud. People move to the big cities. But at a certain point, and we've seen this in the high-tech states like New Jersey, Connecticut, et cetera, when people hit the red zone for retirement, they start looking for low-tax places to move to. And those states have hemorrhaged population for decades, really, been losing their retirees.
Yeah, it really comes down to affordability. You know, rents have grown and housing prices have grown much faster than wages have grown in the last couple decades. And, during the recession, lots of people were looking for jobs. A lot of people moved to the cities where the jobs were, most plentiful. But now as the recovery has come underway and housing prices have really outstripped incomes, there's more of a pressure to then, if you can't keep housing cheaper or if you can't grow your income, you have to figure out one side of the equation. So either you get a better paying job or you just move to where it's cheaper. And, cheaper could be lower housing prices or lower taxes. Both are a big factor. So that's definitely what's been happening, all across the country. People are looking to where they can stretch their dollar further, get more space, especially when you're starting a family. There's a huge demographic wave happening right now with millennials starting families, looking to buy homes. That creates a lot of pressure in terms of the housing market on these inner cities or bigger metros, I should say. And, you know, so that's why they're largely looking to more affordable areas. You mentioned Seattle was even on the list. That was one that was interesting, that it was the first quarter. I've been looking at this for a couple of years, but this was the first quarter that I've seen where Seattle actually was negative, where more people were looking to leave, which is very interesting because a lot of people have been coming to Seattle from Northern California where, you know, again, it's all about affordability, right? So if you can keep your same job at Apple or Google and Facebook and go to Seattle where there's tons of those jobs and buy a cheaper home for half the price. But what's happening to the people who are in Seattle is then they're looking to also make the same move. So it's sort of this ripple effect of looking for affordability. I actually am one of those people who just moved out of Seattle back to Chicago, where I lived before, where it is much more affordable. And, you know, so there's these sort of multi-step consequences that happen when people are moving. You know, what's going to happen to Nevada as so many people move there and bring their money? You know, housing prices have been growing. People are getting kicked out of their homes via evictions, have been growing also in Vegas. And so there are these other, you know, second effects that need to be paid attention to as well.
You know, this is sort of a phenomenon that's been floating around for a long time that many years ago, I lived briefly for about 6 to 8 months on Cape Cod, which is one of the prettier mm-hmm. places you could possibly live. And everybody who's on the Cape always wanted to blow up the Bourne Bridge or the Sagamore Bridge after they crossed it. I mean, once you got onto the Cape, you didn't want anybody to follow you. And this is this was true when all of the evacuees of Taxachusetts moved to low-tax New Hampshire. And then once enough people from Massachusetts moved into southern New Hampshire, they started demanding all the services that required taxes to be raised in New Hampshire. And we've seen this happen from Californians going up to Oregon, and there were signs all over Oregon at one point with the map of California with the red circle and the line through it. So people move to places because it's not where they came from, and then they want the stuff that they used to have in the other place.
Right.
And you know, if you do that, you're going to end up taxing yourself back into the same problem.
And, you know, you bring up a good point that they move to places, you know, where they have what they always wanted. And, you know, the migration report for Redfin is largely looking at large metropolitan areas. But I've been able, you know, with our data to segregate it apart into much smaller areas, such as zip codes or counties or cities, where you can then see if someone's in a very urban place like Seattle or an urban part of Denver, where are they looking to move and how is that different? And it's very interesting that they almost always choose places that are similar walkability, similar livability with good schools. You know, they're not necessarily moving to out in the country in a very Republican area if they're coming from San Francisco County, for example. So it's interesting that people move, but they still kind of remain in areas that are most exactly like where they came from.
Listen, it's fascinating stuff. Redfin.com, you can read all about it. Taylor Marr is the senior economist at Redfin. Thanks for coming on with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we turn to a topic that, of course, we've covered countless times over the last 20 years, being at ground zero for the illegal immigration debate here in Southern California, the home of Special Order 40, the grandpappy of all sanctuary city laws. We are promised a full and open-ended debate on immigration. And, you know, Politico had one. They locked four people in a room who all had strong opinions on immigration and what should be done about it, and said you can't come out until you come up with a solution. And one of those folks are with us right now. Stephen Camerata is the director of research for the Center for Immigration Studies, and we have had him on the show many times in the past, and it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show. Stephen, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Appreciate it. Now, I want to say up front, this is an interesting think tank experiment to take four people and say, go in a room and everything's on the table. You're not representing an organization, your personal opinions, but come up with a solution. And when I looked at the roster of players, I realized it really wasn't. It was stacked against you because it's 3-on-1, essentially. Teresa Cardinal Brown was there, director of immigration, cross policy, border policy. And she was in the Department of Homeland Security under President George W. Bush. So I guess that makes them think that she'd be tough on the border. But as we know, George W. was an open borders guy. And the only thing that stopped him from pushing a huge amnesty was 9/11.
Yes, I think that would be fair to say that one was a Schumer, Senator Schumer staffer, one was from the Center for American Progress, a far left group, and then one was, someone who might be called, she also worked at the National Immigration Forum, I believe, at one point, which is an advocacy group for high levels of immigration. So all three of them, and then it was me. But, you know, they were all affable enough, and we did try to come to something. It probably would have been better if it had been more balanced, but, you can't have everything.
Yeah, but the thing is, you were able to come to some kind of a meeting of the minds on this.
Yeah, I'm not saying we solved every problem or anything of the kind, but I proposed, and slowly everyone kind of came over to this point of view that, you know, what if we had a policy that said, look, everybody who currently has DACA gets it. It ends up giving them citizenship after a few years. So that's a little less than 700,000 people. That's administratively feasible. We don't have to guess who that is. It's people who currently have DACA. So it's that in return for eliminating what most people think is one of the stupidest aspects of our legal immigration policy, the visa lottery, which gives out 50,000 visas a year based on luck. You just apply and we pull your name out of a hat.
Okay, so, you know, we can chip away at some of these things, and I guess that's progress. But, you know, my point, Stephen, has always been everything starts with border enforcement and interior enforcement, because it doesn't matter what laws we pass and what reforms we institute. If we don't have control over our immigration system, then it's a moot point, because people will simply ignore it and we'll be having the same conversation in 5 or 10 years with a different number.
Right. So a great and this is not an easy problem to solve, because when the Democrats come back into power again, we would expect no matter how good the laws are on the books, they'll just do things unfortunately, the way that party has evolved on this issue or moved on this issue to just undo that. So, for example, we never imagined that hundreds of thousands of people could show up at the border and the administration would choose to interpret the law. They didn't have to do it this way, but they did, to release them into the United States, often to their families who are here illegally as well. So in other words, we always thought, well, look, if there's an agent and a wall, that'll at least stop people from coming. But it turns out, given an administration, that can happen, and that did happen in the Obama administration with the often referred to as the unaccompanied minors, but mostly they were coming with adults as well. Another example would be DACA itself, this unconstitutional policy that basically had the president not just saying we're going to prioritize certain types of people for deportation, which is constitutional, but to say in advance we're not going to enforce the law on millions of people because of the age at which they came to the United States, and extend them benefits such as work authorization and identity documents. We never thought that a president would do something like that. There are all kinds of other things that the president done which I could talk to. So, for example, guest workers, the spouses of guest workers had never been allowed to work before except under very limited circumstances, but they changed the regulations, and that also tended to cause more immigration. The spouses more likely to come, and now they could compete with American workers too. Now, whatever you think of those policies, these were things that no one had anticipated and were kind of invented by the Obama administration, but it's important to remember that no matter what's on the books, it appears at this point that whatever an administration wants, it can do. And so that is an enormous threat to the integrity of the process. And you're right, it's not clear that we're ever going to enforce our immigration laws given that reality. It's a very disconcerting fact, but it's worth considering.
We're talking with Stephen Camerota, Director of Research for the Center of Immigration Studies. CIS.org is their website, CIS.org. The thing is, while the Obama administration used to, whenever they'd feel any heat on the immigration issue, they say, we've deported more people, blah, 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 blah. But it was sort of a push-me-pull-you policy. On the one hand, they were deporting people. On the other hand, they were encouraging literally thousands of children to walk across the border. in some cases, many cases, unescorted. We had Border Patrol agents tell us we're not catching them. They're catching us because they knew that they were going to just be given three hots and a cot and reunited with family members already here. But
half of them had their family members already with them, adults
right.
with them as well.
Right, yeah. right. But the thing is that all of these issues that we've been just talking about predate Barack Obama. I mean, our broken immigration system has been broken basically since the Ted Kennedy Immigration Reform Act 1965. And I've quoted 1,000 times Jimmy Carter's position paper on August 4th, 1977, when he was president. And the Democrats used to use essentially the same language that Donald Trump is using as recently as the early 1990s. We could play tapes of Hillary and Bill Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and other prominent Democrats talking about how the influx of illegal aliens, and they used to use the statutory term before it became branded hate speech, of deflating the wages of working people and putting a strain on the social safety net in municipal budgets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that all changed. It changed after the 1990s, really, when essentially Maria Elena DeRazzo here at the L.A. County Federation of Labor decided that the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, was going to be pro-open borders. And the power of a union labor started to lean on the Democratic Party, and all of a sudden they reversed themselves. And now we've got this ideological split where you're asking the Democrats to essentially cut. They believe that illegal immigration works for them on two profound levels, as you know. One, in the immediate present, it provides customers for social welfare programs that they administer, and that means more power. And in the long run, an amnesty means voters and a permanent majority. And that's very hard to get a political party to go against those very selfish but real, tangible net gains.
Right. I mean, it would be fair, however, to say that it's immigration generally that has this effect. In fact, legal immigration has are extremely generous. High levels of legal immigration has probably the more profound political effect, because it's true that illegal immigrants, we do draw congressional and local districts to accommodate the inclusion of illegal immigrants who are counted in the census. So the political power of them is already felt even long before we amnesty them. But it's really the case that it's legal immigrants who are adding enormously to the Democratic voter base, because it looks like about 2-to-1 legal immigrants and their children vote for the Democratic Party. And the reason for that is they generally agree with the party. When you ask them about questions on health care or gun control or the size of government or taxes, new immigrants and their children generally say that they align better with the Democratic Party. It has nothing to do with the Republicans' party or position on immigration. It has to do with what folks think. And in a democracy, the political system has to reflect the voters. And if you change who the voters are, you change the general direction of public policy. It would be wrong if that didn't happen. But in that context, the cost of immigration, whether legal or illegal, to taxpayers or the job competition or the impact on sort of society more generally when it comes to issues of assimilation and culture, the Democrats have decided they're not going to think about any of those questions. And you're right. It wasn't that long ago that they did. There's a very famous commission in the 1990s. Barbara Jordan, the first African-American woman elected from the South, was appointed to Bill Clinton to that commission. And it made a series of recommendations, including reducing the overall level of legal immigration and a whole series of things enforcing the law, particularly going after the employers who hire illegal immigrants. But it wasn't implemented, but it was certainly the case that in the Democratic Party, those views were more mainstream. Today, the Democratic Party's views have become extremist, that anybody who makes it into the United States, for the most part, if they just spend a little time here and haven't murdered anybody, they get to stay. They wouldn't say it this way, but it's essentially a very large fraction of the Democratic Party leadership anyway across the board has seemingly embraced something like open borders, if not true open borders. And it's one of the reasons they lost the election, because the people who don't agree with them, but are politically pretty moderate, gravitated towards Donald Trump, despite all the baggage Donald Trump has on many issues. They still preferred him because the Democratic Party takes this extremist position.
Thanks for being with us, Stephen. Appreciate it. Stephen Camerata from the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS.org is the website.
Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, last week we were treated to the shortest shutdown. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky took to the floor of the Senate and held up the vote. And for a few hours anyway, technically the government was shut down. And he did this to bring awareness to a reality that the budget deal that was being celebrated as a bipartisan agreement, and it was that, added over $1 trillion to the deficit. Do we no longer care about deficits? To talk to us about that and more, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Congressman Tom McClintock. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Just fine, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
This is an issue that you've discussed, and you were the go-to guy for the budget in Sacramento, and you know about as much about the budget as anybody in Congress. And yet, you know, Rand Paul was vilified for this, but he had a point, an important point. Do we care about this anymore? Is this something where we've just thrown in the towel?
Well, the short answer is obviously we don't care about it anymore, but we're about to, because markets are going to come back and start to tell us what any creditor tells somebody when they're in over their head. I'm not going to lend you more money. Now, that's going to happen gradually, and it'll be reflected by higher and higher interest rates. But economists warned the budget committee last year that we hit trillion-dollar deficits. That's going to destabilize markets. There's no way to predict when a sovereign debt crisis hits us. That is a point where lenders simply stop loaning the country money. But they said when you get up to about $1 trillion of deficit, you will have set the stage for such a crisis. If you want to know what that crisis looks like, it's going on right now in Puerto Rico. It's going on right now in Venezuela.
Congressman, it has been my theory anyway that the reason people – because you and I have been talking about this for I don't know how many years – but in general, it's a staple of AM talk radio. It was a staple of conservative rhetoric. And I think that for a lot of people, this doesn't resonate. It's sort of like the drought, that until you turn on the faucet and dust comes out, there's X number of people don't take the drought seriously. And we've talked about the dangers and the realities of budget deficits. But if people don't feel it, they just hear another continuing resolution. Government continues. They're not feeling it on a daily basis. They don't take it real. It's like the city of Los Angeles with the amazing drop program that was exposed of $1.6 billion of extra pension and salary payments to cops and firefighters that nobody even talked about. I mean, they just keep going on and on and on.
It gets more confusing at the federal level because we're basically working against ourselves. We just approved a massive tax reduction. That was absolutely essential to produce economic growth. It's already having a dramatic positive effect on wages and business expansion. But once you've cut taxes, you then have a huge responsibility to restrain spending growth as well. Obviously, and people talk as if taxes and debt are opposites. They're the same thing. A debt's simply a future tax. Both taxes and debt, future taxes, they're both driven by spending. Once we've spent a dollar, we've already decided to tax it. The only question is, do we tax it right now, or do we borrow it now and tax it in the future? And if we borrow it now, it also has real-world implications for the present, because you're borrowing from the same capital pool that would otherwise be available to loan to consumers to make consumer purchases. And remember, two-thirds of economic growth depends upon consumer spending. It's no longer available to loan to home buyers seeking to buy homes, which has enormous impact on the home building industry. Not there to finance businesses seeking to expand and add jobs. So we're undermining the economic growth that we achieved with the tax cuts.
You know, I've reduced this to modern mess to the following. We traded tax and spend liberals for borrow and spend conservatives. And arguably, of the two, borrow and spend is much worse than tax and spend. At least with tax and spend, you are paying for your spending. Whereas what we're doing now, it just seems like we're just kicking the can down the alley and pretending like it's not going to have to get paid back.
And with $20 trillion $1 trillion of debt. Any increase in interest costs is going to have an enormous impact on the current budget. Interest rates are already going up. The larger the deficit we run, the higher interest capital markets are going to demand to compensate them for their additional risk. You have a 1% increase in interest rates. That's $200 billion added to our annual spending. And it does nothing but simply rent the money that we've already spent. We're going to borrow about $1 trillion this year. Part of that's to backfill funds that we depleted in previous episodes. But we're running about almost a $700 billion actual deficit this year. That's about the size of the entire military. So if you want to look at it one way, our entire military defense spending is now being paid for with borrowed funds.
We're talking with Congressman Tom McClintock. Congressman, let me shift gears for a second because the immigration debate is now coming to Washington. This is what's next up. Are you optimistic that there's actually something that can come out of this that would deal with some of the many issues we've discussed over the years?
Well, theoretically, yes, it's a very simple situation. You've got a lot of people who were brought here illegally as children. They're stuck here without legal status. At some point, you've got to recognize their legal status. But you can't do that until you secure your borders. Otherwise, you encourage another wave of illegal immigrants bringing their children, or for that matter, sending their children. A lot of these were unaccompanied minors. You've got to secure the borders. At the same time, you're legalizing those DACA participants. The problem is, the Democrats, the Republicans are willing to say, okay, we will legalize this population. We understand the problem, but we've got to secure the borders or we're going to have a bigger problem. The Democrats are saying, legalize, and we don't want any border security. And as long as they take that position, as a practical matter, I don't see a resolution of it.
As always, we thank you for coming on and talking to us, Congressman Tom McClintock. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC. AM.